Today is April 23rd, 2019. Can you tell me your full name?
My full name is Joseph Lawrence Gray.
All right, and when and where were you born?
I was born in Sisters Hospital, August the 27th, 1922, on the fourth floor.
Do you know how your family came to be in St. Joseph?
My father was born in Severance, Kansas, and my mother was born in Sparks, Kansas, and her parents had moved into St. Joe before my father did. He was a farmer, or in a farm family, and anyhow he moved over here in the early 1900s. I don't know when, but there's stuff in here I'm sure that'll tell you some of that. And anyhow, they got together in St. Joe and were married in St. James Church down in South End. And they lived here the rest of their lives.
Okay. So you were a Southside St. Joe family?
Yeah.
Is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up at 24th and Pacific. That was in the mid-side. It's not in North or South.
When did they move there?
Excuse me?
When did they move to there?
About 1917 or 18, somewhere around there.
Okay, so you grew up on Pacific. What do you remember about that part of town and when you were young?
Well, I remember a lot of things. I don't know what type of things are vendors, but we were in the middle of the block on the west side, 1924 South 24th, actually, we lived on that. It's a short block, only three houses long, and behind us to the west were two or three tennis courts that people were still playing tennis on. They had nets and all. When I was a young child, they went to pot excuse me, I have bronchitis.
Oh, you're fine, you're fine.
It makes me gargle when I talk, but my internist said it's not contagious and it's not curable. You just have to live with it, so I do my best. Anyhow, they started deteriorating. They didn't maintain them, and the neighborhood kids all tore the wire off of there, and including me, one of the kids, and then some of them broke the, he got on the poles and swinging them back and broke them off, and anyhow, the city finally took them all down, and we made baseball diamonds out of the tennis courts, and anyhow, with little kids it was fine, and as we got bigger, they were hitting them out into Pacific Street, and that was dangerous to the traffic. So the city made us go. The axis of the ball diamond was not north to south. It was west to east. It gave us more room, but we had the only three-tiered baseball field in the world, probably. But it served a purpose, and anyhow, we had a lot of fun there. There were a lot of youngsters in our neighborhood that I would say that if you took one block each direction from where we lived, that there were probably 100 kids in there, at least 100, and we all knew each other, and it was a good, friendly neighborhood. To the south of us was Mr. Summers' tomato patches. He grew tomatoes, and he shipped them to the big restaurants in as far as Chicago, St. Louis, Chicago, Kansas City, and he had 30 or 40 acres of them, and he had, I guess, the itinerant people that came around, worked in a thing for tomato pickers and all. And anyhow, as time went on, I was still a youngster when I think he died, and they didn't want to complete it, so they sold the place where a housing development went in, and that closed out that phase. I don't have these things lined up, but I can remember when Lindbergh flew across the ocean, and everybody was so astounded, and of course it didn't impress me that much, but anyhow, he came out to our airport one time, and I went out there and got to see him. I didn't meet him or anything, but that was quite an honor. And oh golly, I don't have my mind connected for things that maybe if you just ask me some questions.
Yeah, that's all right. We'll get to, I was actually going to ask you about Lindbergh, because I had been told that you had seen him when you were younger.
Yep.
Do you remember what year that was and how old you were?
Well, I was 5 or 6 years old, and he came out to the airport one time, and Dad took me out there, and when I don't know if I met him and shook hands with him, but I got to see him and hear him visit with other people, and anyhow, I was very impressed by the airplanes out there. And you know, that's a non-event type of an event, but
mm-hmm.
but ask me some other questions, maybe.
All right. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents and how they met and what they did?
Well, I think they met through their church. I'm not sure of that, but that's my understanding. And they were married in St. James Church in 1917 or 18, something like that. That's all in those papers there. You can get the details there if you are interested in them.
And what did your parents do for a living?
Well, my dad, as I said, was initially a farmer, and he came over here. Well, when he left the farm, he went, and don't ask me why, but he went to Wheeling, West Virginia, where he started becoming a tire dealer. And he missed the places and people back here, but he did fairly well in tire work. And it was, this area at the time had a lot of Italian population, and they had their version of Pendergast, where he was the head of the mafia back there. And anyhow, Dad, he when he decided to leave, he said that some Italian young lady came in, and she had two or three children, and her car had just horrible tires on it, and anyhow, she didn't have any money or anything, and so he gave her some used tires that he had in stock just to help her get on her feet. And I don't know anything about her husband or anything like that, but evidently he was not on the scene, and she was kind of desperate. And anyhow, he said one of the goons came down from the clan that kind of ran the town and said that he had, this lady had told him about Dad's generosity, and he said, if you ever have any problem with anybody in this town, let me know and we'll make sure that you don't have it again. And he said, it kind of made my flesh crawl, and he said, I thought, I don't want to be wound up something like that, so I'll go back home and start my stuff. And so he left town. Anyhow, that was his version of it. And when he came here, he continued his tire business, and he, as a farm boy, he was what they called a tinkerer, and that was somebody that wasn't trained in mechanics, but they had to work with it, and they learned a little bit about it, and they could do minor repairs and whatever else, and so they had no mechanical or engineering training except by other tinkerers, and so he saw all kinds of things that were wrong with the equipment that to work on tires and do mechanical work. He did things like mufflers and tailpipes and, you know, the rudimentary stuff, and which he'd learned on the farm how to replace that. Necessity was the mother of invention. And anyhow, He my mind is wandering around and I get lost. Anyhow, he started making stuff for himself because he, as a tinkerer, he knew enough about mechanics that he could make things that were better than anything he could buy when he was in the business, because he knew what was needed. And his fellow tire dealers would see that. Where'd you get that? And he said, well, I made it. Well, will you make one for me? And said, yeah, well, so he started Gray Manufacturing, a company he called it, back in 1917 or 18, somewhere around there. We don't know the exact date. But his first patent was 1921. And it was, what was it for? I think it was a wheel aligner. Because they didn't have anything good to align wheels with except look at them. And it was a very rudimentary thing, but it worked. And he had more and more people coming to him wanting some of the things that he'd made for himself. And so he started the Gray Manufacturing Company to make these things, and most of the time he'd have no employees. He wasn't really pushing it, but he had half a dozen or so that he could call on if somebody wanted orders, and he could call on them, and they'd make the stuff on the side. That's how the company got started. And he carried it as an off and on business until he got into retreading and recapping. And the stuff there was the same way. So he had learned more about manufacturing, and he started running it full time in the early 30s, I would say. But what happened when in his retreading and recapping, he was doing very well in it, and the World War II was on the brink, and people at that time were not wanting retreading and recapping tires as much as they wanted new ones, because they put a ration on them, and they charged the same initially. You had to have a ration ticket for a recap one or a new one, and they all wanted new ones, understandably. Well, he He had his recapping and retreading thing kind of went south, if you will. And when the war broke out, they put some real strict regulations on them. And he couldn't sell tires anymore. He couldn't get them. And the defense took over everything. And he couldn't recap them because they had limits on those. It wasn't enough he could make a living, and so he designed and built a machine that would take tires that they were throwing in the dump, and he would. He fixed some cement that would hold them together, and he had some metal troughs made that you could make what they called camelback. That was the stuff that they wrapped around an old tire carcass, and you would cement it to there, and then you'd bake it in place, and that was a recap. Well. They wouldn't let him use the commercial camelback, but he made these things where he could make his own camelback. Now, it would only last 5 or 6,000 miles in the city, but at least they could buy it without any priority tickets or whatever they call those things. And anyhow, He started selling those things. He also bought a lot of junk tires from the junkyards, and he could grind the tread off of them with his things that he'd made in the past, the old tread, and prepare it to recap it. And so he made recap tires that would go anywhere from 4,000 to 7,000 miles in the city, and they called them inner tube protectors, and that's they weren't much more than that. But anyhow, he continued that, and the government found out that he was doing it, and they put the same requirement on there to buy those as they would put on a commercial recap, and there were two different things, and that just put him out of business. And so anyhow, he started making small hand tools and other things for retreaders and recappers, and he had a one man or two man operation, and he was dispirited because of the thing, and anyhow, in the meantime. I'd gone to KU, where I was a member of their first aeronautical engineering graduating classes, and it was 1944. They had taught aeronautical engineering there as majors, but they did not have a complete course. And they didn't have the credentials to be able to award a Bachelor of Science. And in 1944, they got those credentials together, and I was in the first graduating class that had a Bachelor of Science. And I just came back a couple of weeks ago from the 75th reunion. It wasn't a class reunion because I'm the only one left out of it. We only had about, we started out with 9 or 10 people in the class, and the first few days or week, three of them left. We never saw them again, and then we wound up with 7 of us getting diplomas, and I'm going to all kinds of different sections, but it's kind of the path of my life. But anyhow, at the at the school there, we had a really outstanding education. With only 7 in the class, the chair of the department taught most all the aeronautical courses. And he, since they were small classes, and we had to have a deferment because the war was going on. Well, your deferment was based on 3 criteria. You had to be studying a discipline that the military and the government was interested in getting more people who knew it. You had to take a full course of subjects in that thing, and it was 19 hours at that time, which was pretty heavy load. And you had to maintain a B or better average. And if any of those 3 were there, you were automatically, or if they were lost, you automatically were inducted. They had the right to induct you any time. So that was another thing. If they needed you, they called you. And anyhow, when we got through, we went 9 semesters total. And after we got our diplomas, they were awarded. The head of the department told us, said, you guys don't realize it. Well, when we had our classes, they were informal, like you had a tutor. You could interrupt him at any time, talk back and forth, and we were all fairly good students with a B or better. And so we didn't have to go slow for the ones that would be C to D or struggling. And anyhow, he told us that we had covered his full academic coursework that he had to go through at University of Minnesota for his master's program. And I had higher math and all that kind of stuff. Well, when we left there, I went to NACA, which is the father of NASA, in Langley Field in Virginia, and worked in wind tunnel corrections and calibrations for a while. And the irony of it, in our class, a guy from Oskaloosa, who's a good friend of mine all his life, Ralph May, as an undergraduate in KU, set the highest grade point average of any engineer they had ever graduated before then, and that was, we were the 78th year of the existence of the department. And he had 140 some hours, all straight A's except one course, modern dancing, he had a B in. But the rest of the story is, he and I went back to NACA together, and the good old government, they needed some more people. Well, they drafted him from there, and they sent him to Fort Riley to make a mule packer out of him. And they did that and sent him to Guam, where he spent the rest of the war. And this guy with a mind like that, who was taking supplies in the jungles back there where they had no roads. And in those days, a lot of a good part of the military didn't even have a high school education. They were grade schools. And he spent the rest of the war in that thing. Well, they ultimately called me in the draft, and when I went to the draft center, I asked for Navy, and I got in the Navy, which was a blessing. I thought the Navy didn't hike like the Army did. I didn't want to be hiking around all the time, but I was wrong. Anyhow, let's see, what I was going to say. I forget where I was.
You'd gone into the Navy.
Well, anyhow, when I started, I got in the Navy, and they sent me to boot camp, after which they put me briefly in radio school, and then somebody learned that I had a Bachelor of Science in Aeronautical Engineering, and they called me to Annapolis to the engineering experiment station there, because the Navy was trying to start a guided missile center, and they knew I knew a little something about it. They didn't know how much or how little, but anyhow, I got into jet propulsion work there, and while I was back there, Dr. Robert Goddard, who was the father of the liquid rocket, he invented it. And he had a test cell about 100 feet from mine. And I never met him personally, but I saw him one time. He was lethally in his last stage four. He had cancer of the throat and tuberculosis and a whole litany of health problems. And he died a few months after I got there, two or three months afterwards. But it was a privilege to even see the man. He was a great man. I'll tell you more about him later on. But when I let my mind go, I have trouble picking my track up again. Well, when I got into that, the Navy, we as young kids, we had knowledge that the senior engineers didn't have, and they were already tied into something, so they didn't have the luxury of time to go back and start learning the stuff we had. Well, as a result of that, in our mid-20s or so, we were doing work that ordinarily they wouldn't even have considered an engineer for until he'd been 25, 30 years of practice. And so we were way ahead of the loop. Well, the Navy had, at Annapolis Engineering Experiment Station, they had the propulsion division, of which I was one of the engineers in it. They had the airframe and aerodynamics division in the old Brewster Buffalo plant in Pennsylvania. And they had the tactical testing and evaluation division, which was out at Traverse City, Michigan. And then they had a guidance and control division, which was in the Washington City, D.C. area. I don't know where it was, but anyhow, they decided they wanted to consolidate us. So they moved us, they got the old Marine Air Station, which was located at Mojave, California, right in the middle of the desert. And they moved us all out to that thing. And when we got out there, we did our own flight testing. We did everything that used to be done scattered around, and it really helped in the early development stages of our, the knowledge of missiles. Well, I stayed there until I got my discharge eligibility, and just had a great experience with the people out there. We had heads of big companies and universities and other people coming out there, and so we got contact with the biggest of the biggest at that time, and we were still adding to our knowledge and desirability by people, because there were so few of us and so little known. Well, we when we got through, we had probably 20 jobs offered to every one of us because people wanted to get into it. And anyhow, Martin Company in Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland, wanted to start an an aerospace group. And they hired, let's see, who all did they? Well, Ralph May at that time went back to NASA, NACA at the time, and I didn't go back there because I got more than twice the pay from Baltimore that I could get from NASA. And anyhow, when I got out, went to Baltimore and started practicing, I practiced with engineers from Caltech, MIT, Georgia Tech, and whatever else. And the thing that amused me is that we'd be working on problems and I knew how to solve it. And they say, "Where'd you learn that? Where'd you go to school?" I said, "Well, the University of Kansas." Most of them said, "Never heard of it." And they said, "Well, do you have a master's degree?" "No." "Well, none of them had that." Well, they didn't have the small classes and they couldn't move ahead like we did. And anyhow, that was a big compliment to the quality of education they gave us in the first class. And anyhow, I stayed while I was in Baltimore with Glenn L. Martin. I did 20 more hours of master's level work as an undergraduate, though. I didn't matriculate. They wanted $2,000 a semester more if they put the brand on you. And I didn't have any reason to do that. I wasn't going to become a researcher or a professor. And so I just did it the cheapest way I could and got the information. Well, anyhow, it built up and built up. I worked at Martin for 3.5 years, and then I got a call from the Department of Ordnance in Washington. Now, the Department of Ordnance was at that time a department like the Army and the Navy was. They weren't a wing of it. And they did weapons for the Air Force, for the Army, for the Navy, and for the Marines. They did all those weapons for them. And a guy named Colonel Toftoy, T-O-F-T-O-Y, he was the head of the Ordnance, the Guided Missile Department of the Ordnance. And he had a physicist who was his technical consultant, because he had to award research and development projects, he had to award production projects, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And he couldn't know all that, and the physicist couldn't either. And so the physicist convinced him he had to hire a guy versed in aerodynamics and airframes, another one in guidance and controls, and another one in propulsion. Well, they heard about me from some of the people I'd worked with in there, and so he grabbed me and asked if I'd be willing to come to work for him, and they made me a real good offer, and it was a responsible position. So I went there, and I stayed there for 2.5 years, or three in that range. And
what year was that?
48, maybe. I'm not sure the exact. It's within a year plus or minus of that, or 49. It could have been that late. And anyhow, we what our job was when he got proposals for a research project or a propulsion, or a missile project, that each one of them would review the proposals from our knowledge and say, A, do they have the technical ability to design and do the, whatever it is? B, do they have the financial capability? Do they have the R&D capability? In other words, did they have what they needed, the knowledge that they needed to create this contract where they could carry it out? And if any of us put a negative on it, we sometimes would pull in another consultant just to, we didn't want to kill something that was good. And if they didn't disagree with us, which I don't remember them ever doing it, but it was canceled. We didn't do it. So anyhow, it was pretty heady stuff. You dealt with the, when you dealt with a company, you always dealt with one of their top executives. And in the research areas, you dealt with the heads of science departments, and anyhow, it was really fun. And we were, but I began thinking philosophically then that, you know, I don't want to reach retirement age and look back and say I spent my whole life developing products that were for destruction. I know it's necessary and all that. Well, I was talking to my dad about it one time. I went home and I said, you know, I just, it bothers me, and I don't know what, how I'm going to get around it. And he said, well, he said, I don't either. He said, but, you know, maybe we could start our own business. He said, I understand the business part of it and the needs of it, and you know how to design things. And he said, he said, we might be a pair that could get the job done. And I said, well, that's something to think about. Well, I gave it a lot of thought and talked to him a lot more. And I went to Colonel Toftoy and told him, you know, what my problems were. And he said, well, I understand that. And he said things like that sometimes work out and sometimes they don't. And I said, well, I know that, and that's one of my concerns. He said, well, he said, I don't know how long I'm going to be in this office, but he said, if you want to try that and it works out, fine, you have my blessing. But he said, if it doesn't work out and I'm still here, you got a job. Just come in and hang your hat up. Well, that made it a lot easier to take the risk. And I was ready to do that for two or three years when we started it. It was a hard job, but we got it done, and we went from, well, we were undoubtedly the smallest one. Give you an idea how modest the start was. Sam Fishman was an old young, he was my age, but he was a potato supplier. He had a old warehouse down on 3rd Street, and he'd abandoned it, and it had a dirt floor with about 2 inches of dirt on it from all the potatoes that had been there over the years. And it was about 1,500 square feet total, and it had a 30 amp supply of power, and all the stuff was, well, from the 1800s is when it was from. And the upstairs had a little apartment up there over the offices thing, and men were going up and down there all the time, and they served beer, and we thought it was a numbers game or something. Well, we found out it was a call house above our office. So that's about as modest as you can get. Anyhow, we survived that and grew in it and started taking off from there. And then in the mid, it was 3 years or 4 years before we really got our feet on the ground, and we went from the runt of the litter to now we're the largest in the U.S. And well, we're the largest in the world that produces the things that we produce. A lot of produce do-it-yourself equipment like we do, but we produce it only for the professional mechanic, and ours will cost twice what the, or half again as much as what the do-it-yourself stuff does. But it's almost like being the world's largest manufacturer of spats or cufflinks or something like that. There ain't very many of them. But we have a worldwide reputation. We ship all over the world, and we are very well known. And it's still a small company. In the course of our work of making the jack equipment, we use manufacturing products to do that, and the stuff that they had, there were five or six major companies that made clamping devices to hold the parts while they were being machined. And none of them were worth a darn. They were just terrible. We would buy shoe boxes full of them, and they'd last, some of them 2 or 3 months. Some of them weren't even, you'd get them put together in a fixture, and they wouldn't even work once. But typically, 4 to 8 months was the expected lifetime. We only had one that went over a year in the time we used them. We finally said, we ran out of them. And it took 6 to 8 weeks to get a replacement or a part for them. And the head of our place that Roger Kraft, he lived here in town for a while, but he had a master's degree with distinction in engineering from Kansas State, and he had gone out there to manage our machine shop that was making our stuff. And he called me and told me, he said, we screwed up. We used our last part and didn't know it. Somebody didn't report it. And he said, I can't get one for 2 months. He said, so I'm going to go home over the weekend and design one. And so we can keep production up. And he said, we can make that next week and we'll only use a week's production. And he said, I guarantee you that it'll last as long as some of those have lasted. And anyhow, he made it, and we were back in work, and we'd ordered another shoebox full of things, we hadn't tested them or anything, but we started in designing a better thing and testing it and getting durability in there, and anyhow, we were looking for a new product for that thing to make other than the hydraulic fixtures that we were making with it, and we were doing what they call job shop work. You'd make short runs that didn't require aerospace tolerances for the guys who were making mechanical equipment like a plow or a binder or whatever else that didn't need the thing. And anyhow, we decided that, he said, that would be a good product for us to get into. He said, none of them had customer service. They didn't have parts. They didn't have the quality. And so we had a connection who had worked for the biggest company in that thing. And he knew, have you ever heard of the 80-20 rule? Well, it applies to almost every product. 80% of the volume and profits are from 20% of the product line. And anyhow, he knew what the 80-20 was in that industry. And so he gave us the 20% that were the big sellers that made 80% of the thing. Well, went to work and designed and exhaustively tested the ones that we had, and we introduced them at the International Manufacturing Technology Show in Chicago, which is the biggest in the world. It had over 100,000 applicants and 10,000 booths, and it was really a big thing. Well, the big users of these things all came by our booths and said, well, it looks like you got a good line. We'll wait and see if you're still in business 5 years from now, and then we'll talk with you. And we had anticipated that. This Roger Kraft was a brilliant guy. And anyhow, the strategy was no jobber or distributor, who is how the other companies all sold through them. None of them knew anything about the usage of it. They looked at their customers as a jobber or distributor, not the guy with the grease under his fingernails. So they thought if the distributors and all were happy, that it was a good product. Well, we knew differently, and we knew what they'd do. So we told these executives when they came through our booth, said, well, we understand that. The distributors weren't interested in ours because we didn't have a complete line. And we said, we keep a small supply of each one of these in stock, and they all interchange with the lines that are made by number one company, and they will just fit right in. You don't have to make any adaptation. And they're all tested. We tested them to about 100,000 cycles, and that was... The others wouldn't go anywhere near that. And but the point is, if you ever have them fail and they don't have, and you don't have them in stock, you're going to have to wait 6 to 8 weeks. They said, well, we know that. They said, well, these will keep you alive until you can get them again if you want. Well, they heard that, and they'd call in with one or two orders every now and then, and then later, as they started buying them, there'd be more of them would do it, and they kept increasing them, and we saw what they were doing, and it was doing what we wanted. They were, and people were calling in their purchasing agents, say, you know, the first one of these that we put in has outlasted 10 or 12 of those other ones, and they're still working. And then pretty soon they just threw the other one out, and then we were able to make the other stuff. And so we grew up by serving the customer, not the supplier of the customer. And anyhow, it was a that industry now. We're bigger than all the remnants of what surprised them. Most of them are out of business completely. And anyhow, we had a lot of real heady things that started. And we got into the trade association had no standards. The only standard for the type of equipment that we made was, we didn't make this, but the category of it, the jack that you carried in the trunk of your car, they required that it lift the rated load 1 3/4 times without failure. Now you think of the quality of that means. What they did is they needed to have a standard that they could say it was built against, so they got the weakest one of the bunch and made it where he could pass it. And well, when we got into the National Trade Association, which was the Jack Institute, we were working to our own standards, and I tried to get them to just we got to develop some standards. Oh, we don't want them. We got one, our standard. And I said, well, we do. I said that I said, those things are a pile of junk and you know it. And they said, well, we're selling them. And anyhow, I said, well, if you guys won't do it, we're going to start publishing our standards and developing more, and we will tell our prospects that they are built to these standards, tested to them, and we guarantee them to meet them. And if you guys don't want to do it, we'll just have our standard. Well, then they thought, boy, we can't let that go. Well, then product liability started coming in, and they were suing everybody for not having. Well, we got into it with all 4 feet, and we set up the national standards in our industry. The what they call PALD, portable automobile lifting devices, and anyhow, we were the background for that thing, and we worked in all kinds of different things where we got them to use standards and improve them. But
about what year was that when you got them to start using standards?
Well, we started working on standards. We got into the Trade Institute in 1965, and I got them to start working on it by 67. And the Paul group was assembled by the Society of Mechanical Engineers, and our standards group in the Jack Institute, the people who developed that became the first Paul members. And they're under the American National Standards Institute. And that's PALD, Portable Automotive Lifting Device. And anyhow, it still exists today. And part of our reputation around the world is because we have always focused on meaningful standards, and we build products and test them that will meet those. And anyhow, I'm going too long here.
No, you were right. What year? So when you came back from Maryland and from the government, what year about was that?
Well, when I came back to St. Joe?
Yeah, when did you return to St. Joe?
I came back in 1952.
Okay.
I was in I think it was March of 52 is when I came back. I'd been working in the Department of Ordnance up till then.
So if I can ask you a few questions about St. Joe. So when you came back, you had been gone for a little while. Did you notice any changes to St. Joe at that time? Anything that had changed?
Well, the airport had changed a lot. And I can't say that anything really impressed me, that the old attitudes were still around. And, oh, we can't do that here, or we don't do that here, and it was still largely a sleepy town. Not a bad town. It's a good place. We enjoyed the family life here and good friends and all that, but it was not a lively place. But it's become better now. You know, the difference, you younger folks wouldn't understand it, but from experience, but when I got out of KU, we had career counselors that would come through and talk to the different classes and give them counsel about things to to make their career stronger. And in the engineering area, we had a guy come in. First of all, some of them are stupid. This one guy, he was an internationally known physicist. And he started out his talk saying, I can absolutely tell you that there will never be more than 94 elements. And I can absolutely tell you this, that physics is a dead science. And he went on and on for about an hour like that. And I just did easy courses for, you know, first and second year of physics, and he had a doctorate and was worldwide recognized. I thought, that stupid guy, he just, I don't know who he was, but God rest his soul, he's going to need it. But anyhow, another one told us, said, now, the thing that you young boys have to realize, and there's a couple of young ladies in there, you young folks, he corrected himself, and he said, is that while you're state of the art now, you aren't going to be for long. He said, the technology in this field is growing so fast that if you don't study anything for 10 years of the new technology, you're going to be out of date. Well, now, if you don't study something in new technology for 10 weeks, you're out of date. It's changing that fast. And anyhow, things are different.
Do you want to talk about your family life and when you met your wife and how you met her?
Well, I met her in Hatboro, Pennsylvania.
Oh, and what was her name?
Ann Reed, R-E-E-D, A-N-N-E. And she lived next door to a place at Baltimore then, and working on a high altitude sounding rocket. And I had to go to Pennsylvania for aerodynamics tests and things of that sort on the vehicles that we were testing, and I had the propulsion thing was we did not build the motors ourselves. We worked with them in the design of the motors. We had a company called Reaction Motors Incorporated, who was at Boonton, New Jersey. They did the actual construction and testing of the rockets, and we'd go up there all the time for the motors. And anyhow, I stayed in Hatboro, Pennsylvania, and in connection with some of these tests when I'd go up there. And anyhow, she lived next door to me, and I got acquainted to her through another naval officer that was up there that had met her someplace, and we just took off from there. And her mother was abandoned by her husband. He had some, I don't know if it was paranoia or whatever, he had some mental difficulties, and he just left her with four daughters, and she had been a seamstress, and she made a living, but like this. That's how I met her, and we went on from there, and we got married in 1947 and had 66 years together before she died of Alzheimer's, when I was down there at that KU anniversary, April the 12th was our 72nd anniversary of our marriage. She didn't live that long, but we would have made a good marriage. We had eight kids.
So, when you came back, you started the business with your father. Why did you stay in St. Joe? Why was St. Joe someplace you wanted to come back and stay?
We didn't have any reason other than family to be here, and there would be no advantages. We were such a small company that we couldn't get any help from anybody, and it would cost us money to move. Why would we move? And we had a lot of friends here, and believe me, friends are important.
Oh, I did forget to ask you about a little bit more about your childhood, if that's okay. What schools did you go to?
I started St. Patrick's in 1928, down on 12th Street, and I graduated from there in 36, and went to Christian Brothers High School for 4 years, graduating from there in 1940, went to junior college 2 years, and then I went to KU for 2.5 years for the engineering thing. And then I did night courses at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and I did other courses at other places where I was. And so I've got a total of 170 some hours of college credits.
Did you attend the junior college here?
Yep.
What was it like?
It was, I would say, a very good junior college. It was kind of bad. One thing, when I was in high school, we had an excellent physics and chemistry teachers. I mean, they were good. We had good laboratories, and they welcomed us to come in over weekends and work on projects where we could use the equipment, and we did. We really did well. And in fact, we made a chemical one time that killed all the vines on the outside of the building. And they said, "How the heck did you do that?" Well, we told them. They said, "That's dangerous." Well, we do it, but we had the fans all blowing out the windows. Talk about dumb kids, but anyhow, when we went when I came to junior college, I asked them to waive the chemistry and physics classes that they were making me take, because we'd already had that stuff, and they gave us they gave me the finals tests of the prior year, and I've got A on both of them. And they debated about what to do, and they said they knew I was going to go to college if I could, and they said, "Well, college might not accept that if we're giving them high school chemistry thing, even though we did that and whatever." Well, they made me take those courses again, which was like watching grass grow, and they had classes above where I could have gotten something out of it. Well, I got real sloppy in my study habits, and I just quit pushing myself till I got to KU, and I had probably a high C to a low B average when I got a JC. I don't know what it was, but I pulled that up to a good solid B average to an A minus when I started working down at KU. But young kids do dumb things. But when I finally saw the writing on the wall, I didn't have a social life at KU. I had to work my way through. Dad had lost all his business profits and everything, and so I had to work my way through and to pay my tuition fees and everything else. And so all I did was study and work. And it built a discipline in me.
Joanne had mentioned to me that you had remembered the stock market crash, and especially here in town.
I do. I can remember the day that Roosevelt closed the banks. And I was in St. Patrick's School then, and we walked over the kids that we'd heard about this, and we were interested and wanted to see what it was. Well, we walked over to the park then, I forget what they called it. It's the park that right by the Pony Express Museum in front of it.
Is that Patey Park?
Patey, yeah. We went over to Patey Bank, which is just north of it, to see, you know, what a closed bank was like. Well, there were people over there, I'd say at least 100 of them, and they were wringing their hands and crying, and the doors were locked. And they didn't know whether they were going to, they put their life savings in that for retirement. We didn't have Social Security developed at that time. A lot of the banks were never allowed to open again, but the bank reopened down there. And nobody lost a penny in their account down there. They were a very well-run bank. But to see the reaction of these people, and employment just went like that. And the people that I knew, I grew up with as kids, where I knew their parents, and they were responsible, mid-income or lower mid-income, but they were responsible people, and they were good workers and dependable. Well, they were out of jobs, and one of my close friends there had his dad was a real neat guy, and he's a good parent and all that, but they couldn't even get food, and he couldn't keep the house warm, and they. In desperation, he tore all the woodwork out of the inside of the house and got an old coal stove and burned it to keep. Well, he just stripped the house, and there was no chance of getting back in work, and they just disappeared. We don't know where they went. They in desperation, they did what they had to survive. But I saw several cases of things that were that desperate, It's an impression that you don't forget, but particularly if they're hobos. We always had hobos, that they were usually mentally deficient some way where they couldn't hold a job, you didn't see people that were that desperate if they were really people that would work. And anyhow, it made an impression on me.
Did life change for you at all after that?
I can't say that it did. We always had enough for our family to survive on, and our parents were good, and we had faith in the future, and enough to sustain us until we could get there, which is different than those folks were. And we had health care and things that they didn't have, and you know, you learn that it can happen to anybody, and we were fortunate to have the parents that we did, and that they were fortunate that they had the good fortune that they did to have had the opportunity and capitalized on it. And anyhow, I never want to see anything like that again.
What did you do for fun when you were young?
I enjoyed, when I was a kid, I played baseball and I tried playing tennis. That's the most fame I could claim. I tried. I played card games and I like to read some types of books that on the outdoors and all. And I was in the Boy Scouts and had a lot of fun in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts and Sea Scouts. And I like to go out and visit my relatives who are still out on the farms and work on the farms. And I sold magazines and newspapers, and I like to do that. I mean, it's fun to try to sell things to people. And I always had something to do that I enjoyed. But you know, I don't have any particular outstanding thing that I could say, aha, that's it. But I don't know anything more that I could tell you. Just
okay. Well, what was it about later on engineering that drew you?
The engineering?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had always liked mechanical things and enjoyed playing around with them. That's one thing that I did have fun with, bicycles and, well, even scooters and things like that. I always played around with them mechanically. Sleds. I tried to make different kinds of sleds, and then I enjoyed outdoor things like that too. And well, I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, you did. What about it? I mean, what was it? Why was it your calling?
Well, I just I became more and more interested in them, and when I had a chance to study physics and engineering drawing and whatever, I just naturally took to it. I mean, it was something that I had tried to do the same things without the knowledge before, and so here I get the knowledge and learn how to do it, and then gain a lot more knowledge, and that was fun. I always liked some of the sayings that I'd read about. That I remember one that one of our professors had on the across the top of the chalkboard. It was a saying. Who was it by? Kipling, I think. Anyhow, it said, "I've kept 6 honest serving men who taught me all I knew. Their names are what and where and when and how and why and who." And that's a problem solver. I don't care what kind of problem. It could be an emotional problem. It could be a health problem. It can be a banking problem or a business problem. If you can't solve it or figure out what to do to live with it or correct it, you start asking make a list of all the whats that you can think of, all the whys, wheres, how, why, who, and you put them together, and gradually you will formulate a position that you can take that is more relaxing to you. It may not be the ultimate solution, but I've used that whenever I ran into a recalcitrant type problem. I do that, and I still do. And then there's another one that I've liked, the saying that, let's see, what is it? I can't even think of it at the moment, but well, in fact, in one of my biologies or biographies that I took down to KU, the head of the department quoted some of them from that thing. Let's see. Thank you. I don't know where they are, but I'll think of it sometime, or maybe in one of those things that you look at.
Okay.
But you know, those things, to have some good guidelines to test where you are and where you need to go, they're like having a consultant that you have confidence in to help you address problems. And if you don't have problems, you're not doing anything.
I like that. Can we talk about your art collecting and how you got into that and why you do it?
Well, I bought, I don't know if it's in here. Where is that? I had one thing I wanted to show you.
Oh, okay.
Let's see here. Well, I don't know where it is. It got to, I had it in my hand.
Was it this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
This here. Nope, that isn't it.
Oh.
Well, I don't know. Anyhow, we can get some of that to you. But my wife was an artist herself, and she didn't do it commercially. She did it because for pleasure. And she got me interested in art. Now, when I was a kid, if they wanted to get you interested in art, they'd take you to some museum, take you down in the bowels, where you look at a bunch of dour old people sitting there with a horrible expression on their face and outmoded clothes and everything, and they may be great art that was done by a great artist, but they're great at turning kids off. Why in the hell would anybody want something like that? And anyhow, I went ever my folks tried to get me interested in art, and every museum they took me to was worse. I just couldn't wait to get out of there. And now, if they'd taken me to a museum and showed me something like dogs and lions and cats and things that I knew something about, and maybe forests and whatever, but that was never the thing. They wanted the top pictures like that. And that was the way art was taught, by old drones that was the only art they have. I wouldn't have the Mona Lisa in my outhouse if I had one. I wouldn't have it as a gift. And I'm not saying it's a great piece of art. I'd have it for the monetary value, but I wouldn't have it for personal pleasure. Anyhow, she did work. We've got several of her, two or three of her works in the company out there. And she did natural scenes in our forest that we've got here in town. We've got a little place that we live on, and she did just nice things that people could identify with. Well, I got more and more interested in it, and I made the frames for her and stretched the canvases and did things like that, and she sold a few of them, but I think it was more for the ego feeling of acceptance than it wasn't for monetary value. And so anyhow, I got more and more interested in it, and we started going to art fairs rather than a museum or a gallery, and you could see what the local people were painting, and we started collecting some things we both liked from there, and I got more and more interested in it, and we got a new, we in 1975. Now we had collected 30 or 40 pieces by the early 70s, I'd say. And the first ones we started were probably in the mid 60s. But then we started a new business in 75, and that's the one I was telling you that we ultimately started making clamping devices, and it's now the biggest in the world of the type that we made. And when we started doing that, we had a whole new office building that we had to have for it, separate from our jack company. And they just had bare walls everywhere, and it just looked awful. So I started hanging some of our prints and other things in there, and it looked a lot better, but it didn't look good. Well, we started having it be a profitable place, and so I thought, well, why don't we get some original art there? And my wife, she may have been the one that suggested it, but there's, I think it was she that said that the difference between original art and a good print is that the original art has soul in it. And I think that's right, that you look at it and there's something missing, but it's that thing that the original artist put in there that you can't photograph. And anyhow, we both went around and started buying art, and we continued that. Well, we got it to where we had mainly good prints in our gray company. And in this other company, Vectec is what it was called, we started getting originals in there. I started out with, I think, 14 originals that we bought. They were from local shows. They weren't any great ones, but we found that getting more and more of those, and we started buying more originals, but they were hung by me, who didn't know anything about it. My way of hanging a piece of art, you find a place where it's big enough that it'll hold it, put a nail in the wall, and hang it up there. And anyhow, one of the art consultants says, he said, that's like starting a war between them. He said, this one detracts from that one, and that one detracts, they all detract from one another rather than compliment. And anyhow, we got Dorothy Wins to come, and she's an interior decorator. I don't know if you know her or not.
Name sounds familiar.
Well, she's 92 years old now, and she doesn't curate for us anymore. But she's,
I do know her.
She started as a curator, and we had to retire her because we couldn't hold her down. She was getting on step ladders, even was standing on desks trying to reach things. At age 92, and we'd tell her, don't do that. If she fell off, it'd be horrible. And, well, anyhow, we had to let her go. But it wasn't because of her lack of talent. She was good enough that a curator from the Smithsonian Institution, who retired from there, had one of her friends in Kansas City told her they ought to see our collection, and she came up and we showed her through it. And she said, when she left, she said, you know, I don't know who does the arrangement and curating of your art, but she said, in my function with the Smithsonian, she said, I've been to hundreds of galleries and private collections and whatever else, and she said, big ones and little ones and everything in between, and she said, I have never seen a better arranged set of prints in my life. And boy, that's a compliment when she says that. And Dorothy still has, I think that still has the ability. She's doing Vectex, so she doesn't do any gray company anymore. And they're keeping her off of step ladders. And so, anyhow, it was more than she could handle. But we've got over 1,100 works right now. And anyhow, it's been a lot of fun collecting it. And well, at Vectec, I started to tell you, we'd gotten our walls pretty full, and we hadn't repainted it or anything for 7 or 8 years, and it did look decent about like this does here. There are a few little dents if you look at it, you could find them. But we thought, well, you know, we're going to have to build some more offices. We're getting more people. And so let's just take everything down and repaint the walls, redecorate with the new offices we're putting in, and then get Dorothy to hang them back up, which we did. And the guy that runs the company, and we had about 35 to 40 people working in that office. And the guy that runs it is very good with numbers, and he doesn't let anything go that he doesn't have in his head. Well, after we did that, it was a couple of months later, he came to me. He said, I'm fairly good with numbers, and he said, I can always find what makes them go up or go down. But he said, I haven't told you this, but he said, we've had, in 2 months now, we had 9.6% improvement in the productivity of the office the first month, and the next month was 9.4. And he said, that really baffled me. And he said, we don't have any promotions, we don't have any giveaways or contests or anything like that, it's just happened. And he said, I can always find it, but he said, I can't find any cause of it. And I said, well, I don't know either. And the third month, he called and he said, this one went up again, 9%. And he said, it's about to drive me mad. Finally he called me and he said, you know, I finally figured out what it is, I think. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, the environment is brighter and it's invigorating, it builds the esprit de corps, and when they have a more positive esprit de corps, they're going to be more productive. It's just human nature. I said, well, that's a good point. I never thought of it. He said, well, I didn't either. Well, now they're believers in it. But, you know, you look at, if you've got, say, 30 people in there, and it goes up 10%, you save the salary and all the other expenses related to a person there, and the space and everything else, and you have happier people working for you. And you look at that's a significant amount of money in a year for three people's are being replaced. And if more business people realized and had the same results that we did, there are other things that go with it. Art would become a much more valuable product because it has monetary value other than just selling it.
I agree wholeheartedly. I started out as an art history major and then...
You what?
I started out as an art history major in college and then went into just straight history. So I got my degrees in history, but I am a firm believer in art and the response.
Well, I'm having a lot of fun with this Native American stuff. We've got a... I don't know how I got started reading about it, but I started reading some of the Native American history as much as it's known. And I don't know if you ever studied that part of it, but in the Mississippi River to the east, there is essentially no history on the beliefs and practices and ethics, the legal processes, anything that about the Indian habits that still exist. They had an oral history. They didn't have a written history. And so when it's communicated down through a few hundred generations, you can imagine how much it gets twisted around and it just isn't right. And this lawyer who practicing law in a small town about 30 miles, I think it's northeast of Boston, because he was He was born into an old German family who believed in having a real job. An art wasn't a real job. And his interest as a child was art and history. And his dad prevailed on him to get a real job, so he put him in law. And he practiced law for a few years out of respect for his dad. Well, the thing that after he'd done that for quite a while, he kept up reading about history, the things that are going on, and he had studied from Massachusetts to the Mississippi River what was available. And he was horrified when he found out they didn't have anything at all about the culture of the people. In fact, they had many artifacts, which they still have today. They have no idea what they used them for, but they know they used them. And so when he saw that they were doing that, he thought, to the Mississippi River. He got to thinking about, boy, I wonder what's going on out in the West. And if they're destroying the history of the families and the cultures. And he read about the Lewis and Clark expedition, realizing that they were going to find a northern passage to the West Coast. And right away, his history thing says, man, that means within a few generations, the West will, knowledge of the tribes will be lost like the East has been. He said, so I'm going to close my practice and go out there and spend the rest of my life living with the Indians to study their traditions, culture, artifacts, and everything else like that, and taking drawing pictures. Well, he did that. And his stated goal was to live with every tribe west of the Mississippi to learn their history. He had no idea how many there were. There are actually 500 and some that have been identified, and a lot more than that. And anyhow, he went to live first with the Mandan tribes at the mouth of the Missouri River. And every time, see, to record what's going on, he hired two guys to go as artists or bearers of art equipment, everything he needed to paint, and he would go into these tribes and he would always write down everything he did and what he was thinking in a letter to himself, and he would begin the letters with, now if I live through my meeting with this tribe, this is my plan of what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to move on to another tribe. And he'd go in and he found that by painting the bigwigs of the tribe, that it was both a plus and a minus. Some of them thought he was creating a voodoo thing. Others, one of the big Indian tribe guys said, he said, now part of me will live forever. And he said, well, what do you mean for you're going to live part of you? He said, when I walk by your pictures, the eyes follow me. So I know part of me is alive in that picture. And then others wanted to get him like that because he was creating voodoo. And so he did a guarded thing. Well, anyhow, he lived with 42 or 45 different tribes, and he did their histories, and he was an exceptionally good observer of, what's that little thing over there for? What's this for? What do you do with that? What do you believe about this and whatever? And he recorded all those things that a good scientist would look at. He wouldn't overlook it because he didn't know what it was. He saw something else that was more interesting. And anyhow, what he would do then, he'd write these letters to himself. And while there was no postal service over most of the big plains, he knew that some of the towns out there had been reputed to have a post office that he'd be near when he's wandering around, and he'd go in, and if they had one, he'd write a letter to, or he'd post a letter to himself in a box that he had in Baltimore, and he said he wanted at least somebody to have access to a factual thing. He had pictures in these letters and dialogue. And so anyhow, he kept this up and kept mailing them to himself. And he put together two books of these letters. They're about that thick, with pictures that he had sent back. They were scrolled, and they had rolls and all where they didn't have to fold them. And he sent 300 pictures back, and along with a dialogue that explained the significance of all these different things. And he was hoping to start a museum, get a museum interested. They weren't interested in any of that stuff. Well, he was educated enough that he knew that the British, well, the Europeans as a whole, had a really interest, like everybody in the world had an interest when we sent a man to the moon. It didn't hurt whether he was Russian, English, or whatever. And that he knew that people over there were interested in this, just like we were interested in what the man on the moon did and what he found. Well, because of that, and they wouldn't buy it over here, he took everything he had to Europe. And boy, they sold like hotcakes over there. And the museums bought them, and private collectors bought them, and they have, I believe they have as big a collection of his work as all of America does, because we didn't do it. And anyhow, he finally got some museums here that had some interest, and one in Omaha has several of his things. The one's in a hotel in Paris, who had collected a lot of these from day one, and had a lot of clients and patrons who had ones of their own, and they would loan them to that museum now and then for display. And anyhow, they decided that this was too valuable a collection to not have the world be aware of. And so they got together with the major museums and collectors in Europe, all of Europe, and got them to agree to loan some of their precious works to them to circulate to Kansas City and to the Museum of Natural History in New York for exhibit for 1 month at each place. Well, the reason they picked the Museum of Natural History, or the Nelson House, Nelson Gallery, is because it has such a good collection of Native American things there, which was, they didn't loan theirs to them, but that way they were borrowing it. And anyhow, they got them over here, and they had just crowds of people that wanted to see them, and they went to the three places, and then when New York had its month's time, they went back to them and were redistributed throughout the world to the owners of it. But this one book that I got from the Nelson shows everyone that they had and their own collection, and it is a treasure.
It really is. Their collection is very impressive.
And I spent hours and hours down there at that thing. That was really That's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I went to a similar thing in Chicago he's one of the biggest artists they've ever had. Anyhow, they had the biggest collection of his works that ever existed in history. And it was bought together the same way, and then they just dissolved it afterwards. Well, I've got a book on my desk that I got there of his stuff. Now, a lot of his stuff I didn't like, and I don't like any of them as much as I like the Indian stuff that I have. But what is the guy's name? He's much better known than any Indian artist is. I've still got a little time. I had a list somewhere of a lot of the famous people that I've met. It's a trivia thing, but I've got, well, like the founder of the National Science Foundation, my roommate, that guy he was an MIT grad and summa cum laude and doctorate in nuclear physics, and he married the daughter of Alan Waterman. And I was in the wedding party, so I got to go out to their house and visit with them. And Edwin the guy that the telescope is named after.
Oh, okay.
Edwin Hubble.
Okay.
I got to meet him two or three times.
Wow.
He ran the Aberdeen Proving Ground test area where we did a lot of our missile testing up there, and he the first time I met him, I went up there with a group of 8 or 9 young ensigns in lieutenant junior grades, all dressed in the same outfits and all the same age, you know, and he wanted to meet everybody that came on the station. To know who was there and why they were there, and then he said, when you leave, I want to talk to you again to see if you had any shortcomings in the services we provided, because I want to make this place do what it's supposed to do. And anyhow, when they introduced us around the circle, and we all shook hands with him, and none of us even remembered his name or didn't know anything about him, and we left and went out and did our thing that we were up there for, and came back for the review before we left, and he asked each one of us, said, now, is there anything that you came here hoping to do that you were unable to do because we didn't have the cooperation that you needed, and none of we all got what we wanted. And he said, okay, I thank you. And he said, if you're ever up here and you don't get what you want, come back and see me. And he said, I'll make sure you get it if it's available. And anyhow, he then went around the circle and shook hands with every one of us and called us by name. We were nobodies, and wondered, who in the heck is that guy anyhow that goes a memory like that? If you had different clothes on or some distinction, you'd expect, well, he has a good visual memory. But they said that that's why he's such a good astronomer. He could look up at the sky and say, that star doesn't belong there. If there's a comet or something going over, they say he'll never forget you all his life. And anyhow, 2 weeks or so later from that first experience, I was walking along with my test plans, studying them, and about 6:30 in the morning, this saying, good morning, Ensign Gray, and I looked up and it's him. that's a funny feeling. But I got to know Wernher von Braun real well and worked with him, and I got gobs of people like that. That I've got a list of them somewhere. It's just a trivia thing. There's no particular significance to it. But old Louis McDonnell, the one that started the McDonnell aircraft, he say, "Don't call me McDonnell. McDonnell is how we pronounce it." I got to know the people at MIT, Fritz Zwicky. He was an astrophysicist out there, and you know, Louis, oh boy, he was a case. What was his last name? Louis. He was head of the JPL testing area, and he was a very bigoted anti-German people. He hated Germans with a passion, and anyhow, when I worked under Office of Ordnance, this is an interesting story. Von Braun, Tolstoy, my boss, he kidnapped him in Berlin, and his three truckloads of documents and 40 scientists, and brought them to America without permission. And he said, what happened? He said, I was a lieutenant colonel then, career man. And he said that the security brought this guy into my office who couldn't speak a word of English. And they said through an interpreter, one of our guys, that he told the interpreter, he said, I want to go to America, not to Russia. And he said, when he told me that, and he said, I've got three truckloads of classified documents on rocketry and jet propulsion and all, and 40 scientists, and I want to go to America, not to Russia. And he said, I could hear the Russian guns. They were coming in on Berlin. And he said, I didn't have time to clear it. And he said, that's a court-martialable offense to do what I did. I kidnapped him and his crew and stole an airplane and flew him to America. Anyhow, he said, I expected to be court-martialed. And he said, they started court-martial proceedings. And he said, I figured, well, my professional career was over, but this man and his crew and knowledge were too important to not have. And anyhow, he said that I was preparing, you know, to defend myself in the court-martial thing. And he said, when one of the higher-ups of the higher-ups heard about it and then learned they're going to court-martial, he said, I'll court-martial all of you if you don't drop that damn thing. Said, you idiots. And he was very abrasive to him, but anyhow, he said, boy, I breathed a sigh of relief. But when Von Braun was going through his initial interrogations at Fort Bliss in Texas, they said, where'd you get the idea of a liquid rocket? And his interpreter's answer was, from your own doctor, Robert Goddard. And Robert Goddard, the scientist, the top scientist of America, had been trying to get the military to force or to finance some of his work. He was doing it out of his personal pocket. And he conceived the idea of the aerodynamics of it, the propulsion of it, the guidance and control of it, and the load-carrying ability. He did that all himself and made it work. He launched one on his own to 2,000 feet. It blew up finally, but it was a long time before we could make one with all the money we put into it that didn't blow up before it reached that. They blow up mostly on the stand. And anyhow, there's a lot of interesting stuff like that. It, I guess most of it's trivia, but it's still interesting trivia.
Very interesting.